There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Hi, I'm Andrew Bowser.
And I'm Sapphire Sandalo.
And welcome to Alter Weekly.
Coming up on the show, we talk with Jeffrey Reddick about how his passion for horror began and how he created the ultimate horror villain in the Final Destination franchise. Then we're joined by Prince Jackson of the Nightlight podcast to discuss the 1989 cult classic Society.
But first, we're going to do another exercise in cocology. We did the cube test last time. We're going to do a different test this time. Sapphire, what does cocology mean exactly?
Let me tell you, Bowser. So according to the back of this book, created by a famous Japanese psychologist, cocology is the study of kokoro. I don't know if I said that right. Mind or spirit in Japanese.
Okay, so which one are we going to do today? And am I just the subject, or are we both going to weigh in on this?
I'll say my answers too, since I haven't read this in years, so I don't remember what each thing means.
Okay.
It'll be fair.
And hopefully the results of this one aren't that I'm a friendless asshole.
I know. I'm worried. I'm like, oh no, what will this reveal about me?
Yeah.
So this one's called Into the Depths. Ooh. I picked it because it looked spooky.
Perfect. Okay.
You are in an old abandoned building where no human has set foot for years and have discovered a staircase leading underground. Slowly, you make your way down, counting the steps as you go. One step, two step, three steps. How many steps is it to the bottom of the stairs?
Six. Bottom line.
Okay, wait. I had to think of my answer first.
Oh, yeah. Well, are our answers going to influence each other?
Yeah. So wait. Okay. So we'll.
Oh, yeah. Should
we'll
we
think
both of it first?
Okay, and then say it.
Okay.
Thanks for fucking it up, Bowser.
Well, okay, it was six.
All right. Let me think. So I'm in an old abandoned building, no human. I'm going to say mine's like 12.
Okay.
All right. Here we go. The underground room is pitch black. Then from the darkness, you hear the sound of another person. Is the person weeping softly, moaning wordlessly? Is it a voice speaking to you?
Oh, yeah, I got my answer. And I.
Wait, underground room is pitch black. Let me see. Okay, I got it. Go for it.
I heard a screech. I heard like a. I almost didn't know if it was human at first. I thought it was like metal on the ground.
Interesting.
But it's like a screech.
But that, it says it's a person.
Well, I'm saying it was a person.
Okay.
But it just sounded metallic at first, but
right,
it was actually a human
like
screeching.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Okay. So mine was like whispers and they were saying, don't go in there.
Ah, like, okay.
Don't go in the room like that.
Yeah, I got it.
How do you react on hearing the sound of this other person?
It's funny to watch you sit there and think through it, experience it. You know, what's weird is I don't run. I'm scared, but I'm kind of like, I feel like that's why I'm there though, is to deal with whatever this thing is. So I'm kind of like, hello, or like, you know, show yourself type of energy.
Interesting.
Like,
yeah,
I feel like it's something that could be soothed.
Mm-hmm. I'm similar. Like, I'm scared at first because the voice comes out of nowhere and is telling me not to go in a room.
Yeah.
But then I'm like, well, I came down here to go in this room, so I'm gonna go in, even though I know something, I'll have my guard up.
Yeah.
All right, here we go. Last question. You hear a person now calling your name and see a figure descending from the light at the top of the stairs. Who is this person coming down the stairs?
Okay.
All right, you go ahead.
Mine's pretty basic. I think it was my wife coming down the stairs.
Hmm.
I think I looked up and like felt some relief that somebody familiar was walking down the steps and that it wasn't another thing that was kind of shrieking and putting me on edge.
Hmm. Interesting. Mine was my sister.
Huh.
I don't know how I felt about it. I think think I remember, I just pictured seeing her, feeling kind of neutral about that. I don't know what that means.
Yeah.
All right. You ready?
Yeah.
To figure out what's wrong with us?
Yeah.
All right. Abandoned buildings and underground rooms are highly symbolic of buried memories and old psychological scars. All of us have had an experience we'd rather not recall, or a heartbreak we thought we'd forgotten. But the memory is not so easily erased, and the things we hoped to forget linger for longer than we'd like to admit. Your responses to this situation show how you deal with painful memories of the past. Okay. So the number of steps to the bottom of the stairs indicates the impact of the psychological scars you're bearing. People who said there were only a few stairs feel little adverse effect from the past, but those who describe a long staircase leading deep into the earth carry correspondingly deep wounds inside.
Huh.
So you said six and I said 12.
Yeah, six. Yeah. But I feel like I fucking live in the past. I feel like all I do is think I can think about shit from like the ninth grade where I'm like, fuck me. Why'd I fucking do, you know, like.
Same.
But, yeah.
Oh my God, dude, seriously. Like, I don't know what is up with me lately, but I keep reliving these like three really embarrassing moments from high school. I need it. I need it out of my brain. Like I need eternal sunshine in my brain.
Yeah, totally. Recently for me too. Recently, meaning last night, I was having some thoughts about high school where I was just like,
what?
I was struck by how at my age, I did the math. I was like, how long has it been since high school? And you're still sitting here thinking about that moment? I was like, dude, yeah, it's wild.
All right, here we go. Number two. The sounds you heard out of the darkness reveal how you got through bad experiences in your past. Those who said they heard weeping have been comforted by others in times of trouble and recovered with the help they received. The people who took care of you in their kindness have helped you become the person you are today. The tears you cried were not in vain. People who heard wordless moaning went through the hard times in their past alone. The moaning you hear in the dark is your own buried pain. Perhaps the time has come to open the door and let the sun shine in. Things won't look so bleak in the light of day. Those who heard a voice speaking to them wear their old scars like a badge of honor, refusing to think of them as wounds.
Yeah. Well, what does a fucking metallic screech mean?
Mine was like creepy whispers.
With whispers, yeah.
Oh, I don't know if that counts either. Wow.
I mean, maybe it's like for both of us, we didn't shy away from something that was possibly dark or menacing or foreboding.
Yeah.
We stayed there and had our defenses up, but you know, the screeching didn't make me run and hide or flee.
Yeah.
So maybe we're kind of pressing into whatever it is that the scar is.
I like that. All right. Number three. We're just making up our own rules.
Hey, we're co-collegists now.
Yeah. All right, here we go. Your reaction to the sounds in the darkness shows how you deal with the painful aspects of your own past. If you went out to search for the source of the sound, it's likely you show the same take charge attitude in your own life. By facing your problems head on, you're bound to discover solutions. Those of you who ran straight back upstairs without confronting the sounds have a history of ignoring problems in the hopes that they'll just go away. That approach may work sometimes, but don't be surprised when trouble stays around longer than you anticipated. Sometimes you need to stand and face your fears. If you are frozen in place with fear, it may be that you have unresolved conflicts in your own past that continue to haunt you and keep you from moving ahead with your life. So we both were still willing to like go through the room.
Yeah.
So yeah, that sounds about right. I mean, I feel like
that's
the reason we're doing this. We want to
totally
dive into our brains.
Yeah, totally.
All right, last one. The person who appeared at the top of the stairs calling your name is someone you feel you can rely on in times of trouble.
Good.
The name you gave is the name you gave is the person you believe will comfort you and help to heal your inner wounds.
Oh, wow. Well, that makes sense. Wow. That tracks.
Yeah.
Your sister is that?
Well, yeah, we talk every single day. And I think specifically for this, like the whole thing is about like facing your past. And my sister's been in my past, like my entire life.
Yeah.
So that makes sense.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah. Oh, I hope people were playing along too.
Oh, yeah. 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 And if you were,
I should have said it at the beginning.
Yeah. Well, if you were playing along, then let us know. Tweet hashtag yeah. Altar Weekly and tell us what your basement room symbolized.
Mm-hmm.
Newsflash. That's right. It's time for your newsflash. Edgar Wright is directing a new adaptation of Stephen King's Running Man. Wright's version will be written by Michael Bacall, and it'll stick closer to King's source material rather than be a remake directly of the 1987 movie starring Arnold Schwarzenegger. J.J. Abrams is developing a new mind-bending thriller entitled Subject to Change for HBO Max. The drama follows a desperate college student who signs up for a clinical trial that begins a wild, harrowing, mind- and reality-bending adventure. Jennifer Yale of Legion and Outlander has been set as the showrunner. Monster High is being made into an animated series and TV movie musical. Mattel and Nickelodeon announced plans to produce a new series that follows the fan-favorite characters Claudine Wolfe, Draculaura, and Frankie Stein as they navigate the hilarity of high school in the hallowed halls of Monster High. The show will be available globally across Nickelodeon platforms in 2022. The movie musical will be released globally next year. And don't forget, your boy Bowser has a Kickstarter for his feature film, Onyx the Fortuitous and the Talisman of Souls. If you want to back that film, go to onyxthemovie.com. And that's it. That's your newsflash. Newsflash.
Jeffrey Reddick is a writer and director who made a name for himself when he created the Final Destination franchise. We talk with him about the real-life incident that inspired the films and how he had to fight to maintain his vision. Thank you so much for joining us. We're really excited to chat with you about horror. So why don't we start from the very beginning? How did you discover your love for horror?
You know what? I was a horror baby. Horror. I have to make sure I pronounce that correctly. I'm a horror baby.
I was a horror.
I remember when I was young, Silent Was Lock came on TV and my mom watched it, but she told me that I couldn't watch it. So of course I snuck into the living room in the hallway and like watched that scene where Danny Glick comes, you know, comes to the window. It's like scratching on it.
Yeah.
And that scene traumatized me so much. I had to sleep by my mom's bed for like a week. And my sister and her slept in the same, you know, they had a huge bed. They slept in the same bed. So my sister knew that I was scared and they were sleeping on the floor. So she'd bring stuff to bed and like throw it at me all night, just being mean. And she knew I couldn't say anything because my mom would have tanned my butt if she knew I was. But, you know, I think what kind of cemented my love for horror and made me become absolutely obsessed was A Nightmare on Elm Street when I saw that film. I saw it at a double feature at a drive-in. I grew up in Eastern Kentucky. We were too poor to go to the theater. So we sat on my friend's dad's truck. He was a truck driver and we turned on the CB so we could turn into the radio station.
Oh,
and it was
awesome.
A double feature of Alone in the Dark and Nightmare on Elm Street.
Ooh.
And so the trailer for Alone in the Dark looked really scary. For me, the trailer for Nightmare on Elm Street didn't look that scary because it showed the Freddy arms. And I'm like, yeah, that looks a little cheesy.
Yeah.
So I wasn't expecting much from Nightmare on Elm Street. So I watched Alone in the Dark. I'm like, that was scary. And then I saw Nightmare on Elm Street and it blew my mind. I mean, it's mm-hmm. still my favorite movie of all time. It's just hit everything that a good horror film should have. An amazing story, great characters, great villain. I mean, it's just, I think it was Wes Craven's, you know, put his heart and soul into that movie. Mm-hmm. And you can tell, like, not that he didn't put it into his previous films, but you know, he had a hard time getting this off the ground. New Line was the only studio to pick it up. And you could just tell he put everything he had into it. And it's,
yeah.
I fell in love with the genre after that. I'm like, oh, wow, you can tell stories and, you know, you can discuss some issues that maybe you can't talk about in other genres. And it just made me fall in love with the genre. And it's been all horror all the time ever since.
So would you say that like the really gory kind of horror is like your jam? Like what's your favorite subgenre?
You know what it used to be. And I still like it if it's done well. I don't like the Hostel-y kind of, I like the first Hostel, but I don't like that subgenre of torture. I hate to call it torture porn, but that's what they call it.
You could also just call it Sapphire's favorite genre.
I know. This happens every episode where I'm here like defending torture porn.
Oh no, like, you don't have weirdo. No, that's the thing is like, that's what I love about our genre. Again, there's so many subgenres that, you know, because I know people that just can't even watch a scary movie, like even a PG-13 right. scary movie because it gives them nightmares. So I never try to talk, you know, I never diss anybody for their yeah, like that's what I love about the genre. It's like there's so many subgenres to pick from. Yeah. I think Supernatural is probably my favorite. Most of the stuff I tends to be in the supernatural genre. I've written a couple of slasher films that I still love slashers, but it just seems like you can have more fun. I think Nightmare on Elm Street really influenced me in, you know, the kind of fantasy horror world where, you know, rules can be broken and things can happen. So I like that. I tend to write that more.
Well, what led to the creation of Final Destination?
Well, you know, like all things, it was a journey for sure. Like, you know, people, you know, and I always like to tell the whole story just because I know people, they hear something and they just think like, oh, I just typed this out one day and then it got made into a movie a year later.
Right.
It was an interesting process. Like I got the idea from, I read an article in People magazine where a woman was taking a flight home from vacation the next day and her mom called her and said, don't take that flight. I have a bad feeling about it.
Oh,
and so
wow.
She changed flights and the plane crashed. And I read that on a plane ride home to Kentucky, actually. And I was just like, oh, that's interesting. Like, I didn't think of a movie immediately. But then a couple of years later, when I was in, I lived in New York and I was trying to get a TV agent, you know, they said, well, you have to write a spec script for something that's on television. So I was like, oh, well, I love the X-Files. So let me write an X-Files spec script. And then I used that premonition as the setup for an X-Files episode. But then my friends at New Line, you know, I passed the script around to them just to get their feedback. They're like, dude, there's a movie in here. You should not send this off for a TV. Like, this is a good idea. So one of my friends at New Line, Chris Bender, worked for these producers, J.C. Spink and Craig Perry. And we developed it. And, the first time that I wrote it, it was all adults that were on the, you know, which is much more the flavor of part two. But Scream had come out, which I love. Mm-hmm. And so teenager, you know how the business is. It's always like, we got to do what's hot now. So it's like, well, teenagers hot, make them all teenagers. I'm like, all right, cool. Then they're like, well, we really like it. And it was like a 6 to 8 month process with New Line where they kept, because I worked there at the time, they just kept passing on it because they're like, you don't have a killer that they can fight. We don't, you know.
It's and the then ultimate finally, killer.
Yeah. I'm like, that's the point. It's death. Yeah. And Craig was finally like, if you pass on it again, we're going to Miramax. And they're like, we'll buy it.
Wow.
So there was a long creative process. And even when they brought on James Wan and Glenn Morgan, and James directed, James had to fight to like not show a killer. Like they were still like trying to get the director. And I'm so glad he fought not to show that because that's, I think, why the movie, you know, stands the test of time is because no matter what part of the world you live in, no matter what your, you know, religious beliefs, if you're not religious, no matter what you believe, since we don't show death and it's just kind of, it's death, it's out there.
Yeah.
Nobody get, you know, everybody can put their own version of what death is onto that. So
what were the suggestions to actually show a specter of some kind, a shadow?
There was one point they wanted a specter. And I actually gave them that in one draft. And like the very last scene, I had a quick shadowy form of it show up.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, this was back, you know, because at first I wrote a treatment, and when New Line bought it, they had me write the script. But you know, back when New Line was trying, they wanted to do it, and they were trying to crack it. I know that I saw one, you know, they were going out to other writers behind my back, you know, talking to them, trying to figure out how can we crack this, and then we'll just buy it from Jeff. And, you know, I saw one where it was like a guy with a suit and a cane, you know, and a black hat. This mysterious guy walked. They would go around and
right.
Yeah, so there was either the monster or ghost versions or something like that. But, you know, I always fought to just have it, you know, because it's just death, you know.
Right.
It's just so interesting because I remember when I first saw the trailer for that in theaters, I remember immediately thinking as a horror fan, I was like, yeah, that's tight. That's tight. Like I immediately recognized it as a novel idea that was exciting to me as a horror fan because it didn't have a slasher because it didn't have, and I love slasher movies, but I just felt like when I was first introduced to it, it kind of hit like something I hadn't seen before. That was my immediate response in an exciting way.
And also just like me, I have like major health anxiety. So I'm constantly just like wondering like when I'm going to die. And so like the Final Destination franchise just like hits me in a way that other horror movies don't. Like just because I am constantly just afraid of everything about to kill me.
I just had a premonition, Sapphire. You are fine. You're okay. Gonna have a life. You're gonna have a long, healthy life. So you can let that stuff go, girl.
Yeah.
Well, I know it's something I'm working on in therapy.
I feel like the second one, and correct me if I'm wrong, starts to establish more of like the visual language. I guess in almost a stunt way, like the way really great action scenes are covered or should be covered. I mean, you always kind of see the things that lead to the death, but I feel like in two, it was amped up with the real deconstruction of those key moments that start to unlock. And they, and you know, even the playful moments of it not being what you think it is that's going to lead to the death. And all of that is so fun. It's so interesting for me as a fan to think back, what if it were a specter, a shadow figure moving? I don't think it would have the same power.
Yeah, it wouldn't have had, I don't think it would have had the same legs at all. And I think that's part of being a fan. You know, that's the difference between being a fan of, you know, and not being a fan of when you're writing a movie like this.
Right.
For the sequel, like I knew, okay, people are going to expect another teen version. So let me start off with a group of teenagers and kill them all off except for Kimberly in the opening. And then I knew I wanted to expand the mythology, you know, and show that the people that in part two were only alive because the people in part one had cheated death. Mm-hmm. I knew I wanted to bring, you know, some OG characters back from the first film. So there were things that I knew as a fan that I love that I wanted to make sure happen in this movie. Mm-hmm. And the thing that's also great about, you know, working in the business and also having a producer like Craig is like, we talked and we're like, you know, the death scenes are cool, but what's really getting the audiences is that buildup.
Yeah.
It's not like, you know, it's that buildup of, is it going to happen this way? So Craig was very mindful as a producer, you know, even going forward with other screenwriters, you know, in future films, like, he's always like, it's about the buildup. You know, yes, you want to have the release, but it's all, you know, the buildup is what gets everybody clutching their seats in the theater. So, it takes somebody, you know, you just need smart people behind the scenes that are taking care of your baby grows up right.
Well, we should talk about your altar short, Good Samaritan. Where did the idea for this project come from?
Well, it's funny because I had a feature script that was called Good Samaritan. And the idea stemmed from the Kitty Genovese story, which it's kind of an urban legend, but a woman was assaulted in New York. And the story that kind of went out to the world was that like 30 people heard and saw it
and did nothing.
So that became part of her kind of zeitgeist for a long time. And that story always haunted me. And, you know, so I wanted to do a story about, you know, people being guilty by not helping somebody. And I wrote a feature version of it and we were, you know, trying to get it financed and I wanted to direct it, but people were like, well, you got to show us you can direct first. So then I took a character from the feature and then wrote a short around this one character who is the guy who records the assault, but doesn't help. Mm-hmm. And then something starts haunting him at his home and eventually kills him. And it's kind of open-ended where it could be supernatural. It could have been him feeling guilty in his head. Mm-hmm. So I really wanted to explore that. And I think that's another universal theme, something that we can all relate to because we all see stuff happen all the time. Maybe not severe as somebody getting beaten to death.
But yeah.
We see all kinds of stuff happen every day where we're like, should I get involved? Should I not?
Mm-hmm. Bystander effect.
Bystander effect. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And the funny thing is, I ended up making a feature version of the film called Don't Look Back, which is conveniently sitting on my shoulder.
Yep.
But on the way to shoot the feature version, there was a documentary on the plane. It's so funny, some stuff just happens on planes. There was a documentary about Kitty Genovese on the plane. And the true story, it's a fascinating thing, is that whole urban legend that we heard wasn't true. What happened is a reporter went down there. He was supposed to just go down and cover this murder case. And he was, you know, to be honest, just an asshole reporter that went down there. It's like, that's a murder case. I can't do it. But then when he started talking to people and they were like, yeah, I heard something, he realized he could put a spin on it to sell it. And so it became this urban legend and the people in the complex were demonized. And the documentary actually interviews people and you find out that some people did call the police, but, you know, there was a point where the killer went away and then came back And so there were people, and there was somebody that was with her in the stairwell when she passed. So there were people that did stuff, and the reporters left that out of the story. Wow. So the story kind of took on a life of its own. So I was flying down to shoot the film, and I'm like, well, this is interesting. You know, yeah. This is playing on the plane. Yeah. I hope the plane doesn't crash.
I don't want too much coincidence. Yeah.
But the short was, I have to say the short was such a fun experience. Because I got a couple of things happened. I got to work with Rainn Wilson, who's a friend who I admire so much. You know, I got to work with Toby Hemingway, who's an amazingly talented actor. Mm-hmm. And I got to work with Jane Badler, who played Diana on the original V miniseries. Mm-hmm. And her and Heather Langenkamp are like my horror goddesses.
Yeah.
She's sci-fi. Jane is sci-fi. But yeah. They're like my two goddesses growing up. Like Nancy, Heather Langenkamp in Nightmare on Elm Street, and Jane Badler, Diana in V. And that's what I love about the business too. It's like, you get to meet people. I mean, like Tony Todd was in Final Destination. Holy crap. Mm-hmm. You know, Candyman was in my movie. It's like, yeah. You know, you get to meet people that you admired, and thank God in the horror genre, especially 95% of the people that I've met have been wonderful. Which I know is not the case.
Awesome.
If you kind of take a sampling of like, mm-hmm. you know, actors and directors across just the whole spectrum, most of them have been like, most have been wonderful. And I haven't admired anybody who I met and was like, they just ruined it for me. You know?
Yeah. Yeah.
So I've been very fortunate, but everybody has been so wonderful. So to even meet the people that you grew up admiring and now some of them are friends of mine, it's like, holy crap.
Yeah. Well, we like to do a segment on the show called Crazy Cues, where we ask a few random questions at the end of our interview.
Okay.
If you're ready for this,
I'm ready for anything.
The first crazy cue is,
yes.
Do you have a hot take on the horror genre? Something that you don't feel like a lot of other people that work in the genre space share that opinion? Do you have maybe, you know,
spicy opinion?
Yeah, like I love Halloween 3. I honestly, it might be my favorite Halloween. That would be my hot take.
Yeah.
Do you have a hot take of the horror genre?
Well, if it's a hot take that's going to be controversial, I don't think Nightmare on Elm Street 3 is the best.
That's the opposite of the kind of hot take I want to hear.
Sorry.
Hey,
all hot takes are welcome.
I want to love it because it brought Nancy back.
Yeah.
But mm-hmm. the fact that it killed her and the fact that the Dream Warriors were set up, but then they only got to have like one little scene where they use their power and they get murdered. It just felt like it was. And I know Wes Craven wrote a much bigger one.
Yeah.
And they had to do the one that they did because of budget. But the love that I want to have for Nightmare on Elm Street is just not there, except for Heather Langenkamp. I do like the Dream Warriors, but I know that that's a lot of people's favorite. I'm like, whatever.
That's a great
spicy
hot take.
There you go.
Yes. That is a spicy take.
Is there a horror movie that you would like to be in, like not as an actor, but like living in the world of that horror movie?
Well, the funny thing is I've thought about this a lot. Because I'm like, there's always a but. So, but I have thought about this a lot. I'm like, I would love to be in a slasher movie because I've seen enough of them that I think I could get away from the killer. Mm-hmm. I just want to make sure that I don't get killed. So that's like,
right.
Yeah.
So I would love put me in any slasher movie. I think that I would be smarter than a killer. So yes, I would love to be in a slasher movie.
Well, the last crazy cue is, have you ever experienced a real life horror scenario, whether it be something supernatural or whether it just be, you know, you had a weird ride with an Uber driver?
Something weird.
Yeah.
Well, I've got plenty of weird Uber rides.
I haven't had any personal, but this is again where my biggest fear comes. It's from people. You know, me and a group of friends were like attacked. Me and a group of my gay friends were attacked one time. And I think that, you know, fear of, you know, either racial bigotry, which I've certainly faced, and also homophobia, which I faced. That stuff scares me more than anything else because it's still very prevalent out there, even though we like to think we're in some kind of new woke era.
Right.
So that's the stuff that scares me the most.
Yeah.
Seeing how evil people can be to each other.
Yeah. It is terrifying. And it's, mm-hmm. become ever more apparent. It seems like at least over the last 4 years, became very apparent how rampant it all still is. Well, Jeffrey, where can people watch Don't Look Back? Where can they find you on social media? How can they keep up on the different projects that you're working on, both as a writer and director?
The best place to follow me on social media is Twitter. My handle is Jeffrey A. Reddick. And I'm the same on Instagram, but I'm just not a big, I don't do enough. I just write all the time. So I'm like, I feel like you have to be doing exciting things all the time to post on Instagram. So I may start doing like those videos where I just record myself typing to make it sound soothing.
ASMR.
Thank you, Sapphire. So I may just do that and start that on Instagram so I can get more followers. But Twitter is the best place to follow me. Don't Look Back is available. You can see it on Amazon, iTunes, all the streaming services, or you can order it on DVD or Blu-ray. It's a lot of fun. But yeah, I definitely update people on Twitter and on Instagram on what I'm doing as well. I also found out on Instagram, not to talk too much, but when I first got on there, I added all my friends from Facebook, and I didn't know you can only follow 7,500 people. You can have as many followers as you want.
Oh, wow.
You can only follow 7,500. So I added all my 5,000 people from Facebook. And then I went through like a dumbass, just adding all these cute guys as they, and then my real friends. And so now it's like, I keep hitting my limit. And every time I have to follow somebody, I have to go through and
you have to get rid of someone.
The whole thing. So if I don't follow you back on Instagram, it's not, I will at some point, I just got to go through and find those dumb accounts that I don't really care about.
Totally. Well, thank you so much for joining us. That was a great
thanks for having me, and Sapphire. And like I said, don't worry, you're safe.
Thank you.
At least got the death thing off of you. Now, you know, dumb people, who knows?
Right. Thank you so much.
Of course. Thank you all.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Oh no, it's time for Better Off Dead, the segment where we discuss a possibly problematic cult classic and whether or not it should survive, or whether or not it's better off dead. Today we talk with Prince Jackson from Nightlight Podcast about the 1989 classic, Society.
Prince, thanks for joining us tonight. We're so excited to talk with you. There's a lot to cover. I want to quickly just have for the Alter Weekly listeners that don't know about your podcast, tell people about your podcast and what you discuss over there on your show.
Absolutely. Well, for those who don't know me, my show is called Nightlight, a horror movie podcast, and it's on the Bloody Disgusting Podcast Network, where we take films that are in the horror genre or horror adjacent, to where we actually just break it down literally scene by scene. So we spoil the entire film. And throughout that, we just talk about either theories or what makes a horror film a fun horror film, or even if we cover a bad horror film, quote unquote, then it's always another dive into as to why that is still such a good horror film. So it's so much fun. It's a lot of fun. But we initially do all of this to discuss and break down the main question that we have for the show, which is why horror?
Yeah.
And it's just like the whole basis of why are we so attracted to it and why do we keep coming back to it? And it's a lot of fun. It is a lot of fun.
Awesome.
It is a fun podcast. It's a great listen. Another topic I wanted to cover quickly before we get into our main discussion is you're a new father, and a very new father, and as a horror fan, what do you think about introducing your child to the horror genre? When does that happen? We did an interview last week with people that run a spooky podcast for kids.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's awesome.
It was a great discussion.
We also talked to a guy who wrote an article about how fatherhood changed how he watches horror now.
Oh, yeah, like that he had a harder, totally happens.
He had a harder time with it after he had a child. He just couldn't take the stress and the visceral nature of it. Yeah.
I feel like it's the absolute opposite for me. It's like, it's so strange. Like very much how I feel like, I'm blanking on his name right now. I don't even know how I'm blanking on his name because it totally just popped in my head. David Cronenberg.
Yeah.
But how he created The Brood and how he was like going into fatherhood and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And I was like, I wanted to watch all these films that had to do with like opposite, gender pregnancies. So like The Mortuary Collection or Alien, Splice, and just all these different very interesting films that tackle pregnancy in a very different way.
You weren't reading What to Expect when you're expecting. You were watching The Brood and Splice.
And that's what I feel like it was. Like honestly, the apps would scare me more on like What to Expect. Because it's just like this thing coming out of my wife. And that's what it felt like in that moment. And now that she's here, my daughter, Ellie, it's been such an interesting way to see her grow and things like that. But like for some odd reason, I'm just like, yeah, I want to see all this stuff now. And it's very weird. And it might be the fact that like I saw my wife give birth.
Yeah.
and once you see that, it's just like, shit, bring it on.
You can't see anything worse.
Cronenberg, in a way, kind of leads us to our main discussion because he's known for body horror. He's known for grotesque mutations of the human form. And we are going to talk about society right now. Sapphire couldn't be more excited.
So excited.
You know,
I mean, the Junji Ito shirt like says it all.
Yeah.
I wore this for this occasion.
That's perfect.
Fantastic.
So real briefly, for those that don't know the film, it's a really difficult film to explain.
It really is.
It's about a teenager that starts to suspect that his family is involved in a cannibalistic cult of some kind. There's shady business going on. He doesn't know why and who exactly is implicated in the shady business. And then at the end of the movie, all of their bodies join together in one gooey mess of an orgy.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Very goopy.
Goopy. And I
like to think Sausage Party definitely ended their film in a very similar way.
Yes. Yeah. I think the visuals from that sequence I have seen influence different horror films over the years, but no one really just like goes all out like Society goes.
Society takes it there.
They take it there. And it's kind of what the movie's known for. I mean, that shunting is what the movie's most known for. What are each of your relationships like with this movie? Do you like it? Do you not? When did you see it?
I could go first. I first saw Society back in college.
Okay.
And when I watched it in college, it was 2009, maybe. I think I was a freshman. And it was this thing that everyone tried to do. All my roommates and pretty much all my neighbors knew I was the horror guy. And they would always was just like, they would even watch these films themselves. They would just like look them up online and like most like notorious effed up horror films ever. And they're just like, send them the prints. So I got things like Human Centipede, the Poughkeepsie tapes. I Enter the Void. And just these very interesting films. And then when Society came up, I fell in love with it. I was like, oh my God, like this is corny and cheesy, like 16 Candles or like a John Candy film of anything. And it's just once it goes off the rails and you are suspecting everything and like the whole town is a part of society.
Yeah.
It's such a beautiful film in general. Of how it depicts society and how it depicts the rich eating off the poor. And it's just, oh gosh, I would just live to just have seen this film back in the 80s. Because yeah, like I just wanted theaters. To be there.
Oh, yes. Yeah. I like it's like gosh. Your friends make you watch it, and then it's like, joke's on you. I loved that movie. Friends
right, exactly.
In college. Yeah. Well, Sapphire, do you wish you had seen this film in the movie theaters in the 80s?
Well, when did this come out? In 89? I think I was 1 year old.
I think it's 89.
I think it's 89.
If yeah. I'm wrong, I will correct yeah. myself in the edit of this podcast.
Yeah, I think it is. I think it would have probably mortified me if I saw it when I was younger and not an adult.
Yeah.
But yeah, I had never even heard of this movie until what, like a month ago or so.
Okay.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, I think, totally yeah, what was it when Prince brought up us discussing it? Is that the first time you heard about it?
I think you had mentioned it at some point.
Yeah. Yeah.
You just mentioned it. But I knew, so I went into this movie knowing absolutely nothing. Which is the way to go, apparently.
It is. Yeah. 100% is.
Very confused. But here's my problem is that if I get so annoyed with how tropey things are, it distracts me so much. Where I was just like, and I was like, not a single person of color. Everything is so trophy. Like, I was just like very annoyed.
Sure.
Yeah. And like, I think it, but I loved the end though, just because it goes so batshit crazy.
Yeah.
Right.
But I wish, I don't know. I feel like I wanted the lead up to that to be better. Cause I kind of felt myself going, okay, when is it going to get like real wacky?
Right. It's such a hard movie to, when we discuss a film in this segment, in Better Off Dead, we try to ask the question, you know, are there perspectives presented in this film and depictions shown that are problematic? And by today's standards, especially. And with a film like this, it's really hard, I find, to sift through that question because it's just batshit. And a lot of what you could criticize it for, it also kind of is what it's making a statement on.
Right.
In a way, right? Like even the idea that it is that the film has no depictions of people of color. I guess the movie is kind of about this like white society that has
right.
kept everyone else out that doesn't fit their mold. Mm-hmm. You know, not to immediately defend society off the bat. But
right. No, of course.
I'm just saying it's a hard movie to criticize because there's a lot going on and even I can't there track is. Its perspective. Like, I mean, what is it saying?
Even right. the fact that it was written by a Filipino American, right?
Stop like Brian, it.
Brian Yuzna. Yeah,
Stop
Brian
it.
Yuzna
was it
is,
really he, my he's, people?
He's from Manila. Yeah, he's from Manila. And it's so when Brian Yuzna, I feel like, had this depiction of this film, like that was so interesting to see it come from that particular lens, because I mean he very much works very close alongside with Stuart Gordon and pretty much the whole body horror pack. But with that being said, like it does have that particular depiction of how society or how white society would see themselves, right? Where this whole thing of the rich feeding on the poor and things like that. And I want to say that's one of the reasons why they made the decision to not have any people of color within this film, because they didn't want it to feel like it was something as of like, oh, these white people are only going after black folk or something like that. But with all of that being said, like I do find it very intriguing that this came from like the mind of Brian Yuzna.
Yeah. But, yeah. Which begs the question, does that kind of recontextualize its statement when you find, because you know I've had an opinion on a film and then I find that the, you know, even down to like, well, I don't believe that would happen, and then I find out right. that the person that wrote it based it on a real thing that they lived through, and I'm like, oh well, does that change my opinion? Because I judged it as being maybe hard to believe, but then I find out it's based on a true story. Does it change the how you receive the film when you find out that the perspective might not have been the perspective you imagined writing it, or does it not? Is the material there to speak for itself?
I mean, I guess it depends, right? Like this definitely happens a lot where you see films like The Strangers or something like that. But where it really kind of, I guess, makes this film a bit harder to digest, like if we take away the body horror behind society, like you have incest, orgies, there's just so many elements to all of this, and it all breaks it down to where it kind of makes you think like, okay, like this makes me feel a little weirded out when it comes to society in general, and not necessarily the movie, but yeah, society for real. Like, it's
we
just
live in a society.
Exactly.
We live in a society.
So IQ for Joker. But like, it's just so intriguing to see how aspects of this film, when you take away the layers of how like really fucked up this movie is. Like,
yeah.
Like, so it's very intriguing.
And it all starts happening. I know the craziest thing is the ending, but in rewatching it before tonight, I mean, man, stuff starts happening right away, which I find discombobulating to a degree, because stuff's happening before I really know who this guy is, Billy, before I really know much about the context. There's already things growing out of people's backs and people's bodies getting turned around in the shower, like 10 minutes in.
Yeah, it happens fairly quick.
I also then kind of just respect it. I'm like, all right.
Yeah,
You know, I was confused. I'll admit I was a little confused for like most of the movie, just because part of the reason, and this really bothered me, is that sometimes they referred to people by their first name and sometimes they referred to as their last name. So it took me a while to figure out who was who that they were talking about. Cause I was like, wait, Blanchard, wait, David, they're the same person. And like, it really confused me. I know that's so stupid, but
it is confusing. It was definitely, there's layers within this film that don't make too much sense, I feel like, to the point where it's just you can get lost, especially with like the acting and so on and so forth, because it's 2 years prior to this, like we got Brian Yuzna, who directed Bride of Reanimator, right?
Yeah.
Where you have Jeffrey Combs and things like that, and then very, very quickly after that, he made From Beyond, or he produced From Beyond, and helped write From Beyond with Stuart Gordon. And it's those particular aspects that you see it and you're just like, whoa. It's just you go from this, and it totally, society was just a movie that was made because he had extra money laying around. Like, it's let's do it. Like, you know, it's just whatever. Yeah. You take a couple of scripts from two guys. I think it was Rick Fry and Woody Keith, I think. Someone might correct me on that one. But both of them, when they came up with this particular script, was just interesting, to say the least, of how they viewed society.
Yeah. Mm. I feel like if I have a criticism for the film, I would say what Stuart Gordon brought to their partnership, I feel like, was the depth of character and was the performances that kind of transcend the material, even at times. Like like From Beyond, when I rewatch From Beyond almost daily, I'm just blown away by the performance that Barbara Crampton gives. She's given such a wide spectrum to play in. And then with society, I feel like almost because it moves so fast and because it's so wild, there's not as much time spent getting to know any of these people.
Right.
Yeah.
But I think that was intentional. Like, it's a weird thing to criticize it for, because I don't think they thought they were doing anything else.
Right.
It's intentional for us to not know who these people are that we're watching.
Yeah, in a way. Yeah. In a way, I wonder if he was presenting these people, and maybe this is me reading too much into it, almost purposefully at a superficial level. Like, I don't know, that one's Billy. I don't know, that one's Stacy. Like, they're just these types. And, you know, we're moving through a story based on like familiar 80s teens. And I'm going to fuck with it all. I'm going to put it all in a blender.
Right.
I don't think that makes the film work necessarily, but I could see that being an intent that Brian Yuzna had. Like, if I were to say, I didn't really get to know the characters. And he was like, you're not meant to. It's meant to be a wild fucking ride where these almost two-dimensional, you know, like archetypes are presented and then like mutated. And that's the exercise.
Right.
I don't know.
I think I'm gonna have to agree, because everybody looks the same in this movie.
Yeah.
Which also makes it very confusing. And when they start to transform and kind of conjoin into each other and have this goo falling off their back and they want to touch it and rub faces, feeding faceless people alcohol, it's all because they look the same. And it's just everyone blends in within this film. And the reason behind that to me is mainly because that's kind of life. Everyone just kind of just blends in into life. Mm-hmm. Like it's very hard to, I guess, make your stamp sometimes. And it's very intriguing to see how that all runs down and things like that. And I feel like it's fun when we create like these personas for ourselves. Like for me, everyone calls me the head knight. Mm-hmm. And like Bowser, you have Onyx and Sapphire, you're just cool.
Sapphire's like completely comfortable in her own skin and is cool as is.
But it's just all these particular depictions that you see within this film that make it feel so oddly organic. And it's I could go on and on about how society has so many different types of allegories and all this, this and that, but it is a film that I feel like should be talked about a little bit more, especially within the horror community, to kind of depict those allegories and see if it can be something that can be remade to today's standards.
Well, that is the big question for Better Off Dead is, could society be remade for 2021 audiences, and if so what statement would it make? Would it just need to mirror whatever statement the original made, or could you see this approach delivering something kind of wholly new and original for a 2021 audience? I don't think there's a remake of society that exists that does not end with the shunting. That has to happen.
Right.
Yeah.
But what gets us there? What allegories that would connect with a modern audience need to be dealt with? Any ideas on that? Or does this thing need to stay in the 80s? It's Better Off Dead.
I think it can be actually remade. And I think in some
ways.
And I think in some ways it already has been done. Like if you take Jordan Peele's Get Out, that's pretty much society. Mm-hmm. And it's just obviously without the shunting, we have the sunken place instead, right? Mm-hmm. And then that transformation of body parts of minds going somewhere else, being sunken down into complete oblivion of poverty. But with that being said, yes, 100% society can be remade. And I would actually love to see it from a person of color's perspective.
Yeah.
Kind of like the way I picture it is very much kind of like Fresh Prince of Bel-Air. Going to Bel-Air for the first time, and you know, you're staying with a group of family members that you technically have never really been involved in.
Yeah.
And yet it turns out that they are a part of this larger scheme of society. And I think that would just be very fun to see broken down in the way of someone coming from a low income area and going to just this higher echelon of bar none place. And it could even be a musician or someone who just like makes it or their form of making it. And I feel like that would just be really clever and really interesting to see. And 100% just like, I feel like the whole, like, I don't know, movie and music industry and whatnot, there's a shunting somewhere.
Oh, right? Yeah, for sure.
Oh, it's 100%.
It's happening right now in LA somewhere.
It's happening
maybe
right
on the top
now.
Floor of Capitol Records. if I was sitting on a stack of cash and ran a studio and someone said, Fresh Prince meets society, I would throw money at it. I love that idea.
Right? I feel like that would be perfect.
Yeah. Sapphire, what do you think? Have you caught a vision for a 2021 society?
You know what? So every time we do this segment, it's so interesting because like when you think about a lot of what people remember about these movies, like so much of what makes the movie is the fact that it came out in the time that it did come out. Like, you know, the effects are great for the time, but it's kind of corny, and that's kind of why it has this charm about it. So like if it was to be remade, it would, I mean, I'm assuming it would have better if like practical effects, but like in doing that, does that lose
the charm
that the original has? So I mean, I would still love to see a remake, and one that won't annoy me as much as this movie did. And I know, like, I talk about it all the time. It's just like, I know that it was like in the 80s or late 80s, early 90s, but I'd still, it's hard for me to like separate.
Yeah.
No, that's fair.
Whereas I'm the opposite. I am inclined to like something if it's from the 80s. And especially if it has that kind of crude, rudimentary charm.
Right.
Well, Prince, thank you so much for joining us.
Of course.
Can people find you on social media and your podcast on social media? Let everyone know how to find you.
Of course. You can find me over on Twitter. I'm mainly on Twitter. I'm technically only on Twitter, but you can find me over on Twitter at The Head Knight. That's Knight with a K. You can also find my podcast at Nightlight_pod, and that's also Knight with a K as well. You can also hear my voice sometimes on that new app called Clubhouse. Every now and then I pop in and do little fun rooms inside there talking about horror films with a group of people. So you can also, if you have an invitation to Clubhouse, you can find me on there as well.
Awesome. Well, thanks so much for joining us. This was fantastic.
Absolutely. Thank you both for having me.
That's all for this week's episode. Here's what's coming up on Alter this week. Paranormal Solutions, Inc., episodes 7 and 8 on February 26th.
And on March 1st, The Follower. Fueled by the hope of escaping her dreary suburban life, a misunderstood teen entertains the increasingly sinister advances of an internet friend in a riff on the 1966 Joyce Carol Oates story, Where Are You Going? Where Have You Been?
Then, Suspense on March 3rd. Having survived a harrowing plane crash, an army pilot finds himself suspended from a canopy of trees high above the forest floor by his parachute. After making contact with his co-pilot on the ground, they realize that something is stalking them in the dark. That's it for this week's episode of Alter Weekly. Until next time, stay altered.
If you want to help us decide what to watch next on the Alter Society, then head over to the Community tab on youtube.com/watchalter. You can catch new episodes of Alter Weekly every Thursday. Get it wherever you get your podcasts, and make sure to subscribe and download. Alter Weekly is produced by Andrew Bowser with theme music by Sapphire Sandalo. Alter Weekly is executive produced by Stephen Michael and Lauren Palmer at Gunpowder and Sky.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hi, I'm Ando.
And I'm Fer.
And we host Niñas Bien podcast.
We want to invite you to listen to our show.
Niñas Bien means good girls in Spanish. But you have to know that this is not a podcast for good girls.
Or for girls at all. It is a comedy podcast. So everyone is welcome to listen.
We talk about sex, relationships, technology.
We recommend movies and TV shows and discuss pop culture in general.
And there is Chisme Ajeno too.
A section we have just to gossip about everyone. So you'll find something you like here.
And you'll practice your Spanish.
The cleanest Spanish you'll find, we promise.
And if you already hablas español,
vamos a ser tus nuevas amigas. We'll be your friends for the non-Spanish speakers.
New episodes every Monday and Thursday.
Hosted by Acast and available to all audio platforms.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.